You're tuned into the audio channel from scorenotes.com.
Hello and good afternoon, Henry. Thank you so much for sitting down with us tonight here on scorenotes.com. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really good. Thanks, Tom.
Great. Glad to hear it. And first up, I would love to just get into your recent score, Gulliver's Travels. And can you just describe your experience working on the feature? Because it had a lot of fun fantasy components that translated really well with the score that you delivered.
Well, as soon as I knew I was going to get involved in Gulliver's Travels, I kind of said to myself right from the get-go that the move is to sort of play to the strengths of the film. With a movie like Gulliver's Travels, you know, you're not going to reinvent the hybrid movie or do like an Inception, or I couldn't call on any of my, you know, drum and bass background, anything like that. But instead, you know, you have to celebrate what it is, and what it is quite a rare opportunity given a lot of what you might call realistic, you know, action films, to do sort of action-adventure that's got a little bit of fantasy, but that isn't, you know, it's not fairies and dust, and not there's anything wrong with that. It's not quite Bridge Over Terabithia, which means you've got license to do a certain kind of score that is harmonically and melodically, I don't know if advanced is the right word, because that sounds a bit sort of self-congratulatory, but it isn't, you know, there's a tradition of that kind of music. I think Silvestri's brilliant at it, and you're not necessarily going to impress anyone with, you know, tons and tons of production on that kind of movie. It's more what you might call good old-fashioned orchestral writing, and the more, you know, colourful the orchestration, or virtuosic if you're lucky, and the more you can develop themes and motifs, then it's one of the few times where you can really get that into a movie, and it doesn't. That's what it needs effectively. And I was very glad when the first playback meeting I had with Fox, I was a little bit nervous because it was fairly colourful, you know, orchestrally. I don't know what people were expecting, but they really embraced it. Like, oh, this is great. This is like, you know, good old fashioned. I think, you know, the words Sylvester and Williams were thrown around, which I took as massive compliments. So I think that was the move with that film. Apart from anything else, when you see, you know, when you got a shot of Blenheim Palace with the assembled Lilliputian troops all dressed up in what kind of looks like half Edwardian, you know, costume, that's just not the time for pulses and filtered breakbeats. You know, that is the time to pull on your William Walton kind of chops, you know what I mean? And so I really enjoyed it for that reason. It's a lot of work.
I'm sure, no doubt.
It's a lot of work because you don't. It's not those kind of cues which kind of evolve slowly over 3 minutes and have no key changes and are built around an ostinato, which is a completely different and equally challenging skill. It's more like, you know, disciplined composition where everything has to be motivated by melody, harmony, and orchestration if you're going to survive more than four bars without getting bored. So, yeah, there's a lot of notes, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and part of the inherent challenges of a picture like this, and a lot of times you see with classic animation, is kind of the abrupt nature in which the music has to stop, start, and go. So what kind of effort is that from a composer's end to be focused enough to deliver as smooth a transition as you did with many of the cues on this score?
I guess you just have to work really hard. One way to look at that, this is going to sound deeply pretentious, but if you think about real composers, not the kind of idiots like us who actually do film music, if you think about people like Mahler, and you look at something like the Scherzo of the Fifth Symphony, that music, which has no need and is not motivated by picture demands, has the most incredible, like, schizodynamic turns all over the place, which are completely, you know, compositionally motivated. It's not because someone's telling Marley he has to do this, that, or the other. That's just how it is. Same with, if you look at a lot of Richard Strauss tone poems, they're all over the place. You'll go from absolutely heroic to sort of plunges of despair, and I mean, you don't quite get, you know, the comedic turns you get in films. But I guess all I'm saying is, if you know your 19th century composers properly, you shouldn't be too afraid of being a long way from, psychologically a long way from where you were musically like 2 bars ago. A lot of it is just committing to it. And I'd had a bit of practice because with things like, you know, Kung Fu Panda, Monsters vs. Aliens, you'll get a lot of misdirects and sudden moments and comedic things that you just don't get in live action. And I suppose you just, you know, you just do your best, really, and eventually no one notices the turns. But it's amazing what you can get away with if you sort of do it like you mean it. If it sounds like composition, that's the thing. If you do it in such a way, like I say, just going back to classical composers, if you do it so that it doesn't feel like harmonically and melodically it was like necessitated by picture, but can deliver it with some conviction as if that's what the music might have done had there not been picture, then it's less questionable, because there's a sort of, you know, in terms of the internal mechanics of the music you're writing, it is not, that's where the sense of awkwardness comes, if your actual compositional intent sounds compromised. But if you've actually written it with as much conviction as you can muster to hit various points or come out and come in like you mean it, like you're going for it, then chances are you've got some chance.
Yeah, and the no shortcuts with that, it sounds like. I mean, it's precise and a lot of effort, and you know, it came through beautifully, and part of that beauty is associated with the vibrant polish of the sound and the performances. And can you just talk a little bit about what went into producing such a wonderful recording as the end product came out?
Well, here's the thing, with Gulliver's Travel, again, like, I mean, X-Men's a completely different story where the mix will be hybrid as hell. You know, there's all kinds of weird noises going on. Again, Gulliver's Travels, there's no point, there really is very little of that. So I thought, well, you know, on the one hand, compositionally, let's reach back to, I don't know how to describe it, you know, Silvestri style, Williams style, family action adventure type movies. And by the same token, production wise, there's quite a vogue for mixing, you know, samples with real stuff, and often that can be really, really effective, especially on quite minimalist, not moving, not key changey, you know, kind of music. But with this one, it was like, right, here's how it's going to work. We're going to record it, right? And then the mix is going to be the recordings from the stage. That is it. I mean, bar the odd, and there may have been the odd sort of perk, percussion bang or whatnot. And Nick Woolidge, the engineer, was completely on board that, I mean, obviously anyone who records an orchestra is fully intend to do the best job they can. But, you know, depending on the movie, you know it's going to be blended in with various other elements. This was often, you know, the conductor lifts his stick and sort of what you hear is kind of the cue. And we took the same project. Amazingly, I did actually spend, because I've got a background in records, which is often a total curse, I spent a long time mixing it. Not because there was any fake stuff going in, but just because you'd be amazed what massaging you can do just with finessing mic positions and automation. While still, I was obsessed all the way through mixing. It was like, I'd love to do this, I'd love to do that. And then we'd listen and hold on, does it still sound natural? Like, can you feel the... can you spatially feel some weirdness going on, you know, because we're pushing a spot mic, or can you, you know. So there was an awful lot of massaging in the mix, but funnily enough, really only in order to achieve a completely natural end that had all the right balances I wanted. And if at any time I was trying to do something where by the time we'd implemented, you know, the automation moves, it just started to sound a little bit plastic surgery, then, you know, me and Nick would abandon it and go, you know what, you know, the oboes are here too quiet, but it sounds better than when the spot mic's up a bit. So it was a sort of weird, it's almost like a deceitful plastic surgery where after all the fiddling, it sounds as natural as humanly possible.
And I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at some of the positive fan and critical reaction to your score, but, you know, if you have, I'd just like to know what that kind of recognition means to you for your efforts on something like this.
Oh, you'll have to direct me to them. But the problem is I'm always working, but I can tell you this right now, it means a ridiculous amount. I'll tell you for why. Because sometimes when you're working really hard on material that is, you know, compositionally motivated as opposed to kind of production motivated, you can really kill yourself and think, well, is this, you know, is anyone going to notice any difference? I could probably get away with sort of drifting through this thing in D major with a few plinks and plonks and the odd celeste hit, and then, you know, we can all go home. And, or, you know, you'll be in the midst of really big orchestration where you're doing the most frenzic string runs and using octatonic scales on the way up and, like, you know, diminished something or other on the way down, and you're thinking, is anyone going to notice this? It's just me, you know, I could have just held the strings, cranked the brass up, and, you know, again, we could all go home. So when you really do something like that, and there are people who go, oh, I can hear that someone's actually trying to do something half decent there, I tell you, it really does mean a lot. You know, if ever I found myself thinking I could sort of cut any musical corners, which is so not in my nature anyway, I tell you, it really does. Because it's an odd feel. Like, film music is the sort of thing, you know, I mean, you talk about fans. It's not fans like, you know, people have pop stars have, like, millions of fans and all the rest of it. But that's the sort of sociological, weird worship that teenage girls and teenage boys have because of the, you know, I don't know, well, that's a long conversation. And mostly to do with the vacuum caused by modern capitalism. But the point being that music, film score fans aren't, you know, crazy developing people. They're people who actually sort of keep an ear out for music and occasionally say nice things when they hear something they like. So it's almost like it's almost sort of critical approval in a way, because in order to spend any time listening to film music, in a way you've got to have a slightly more, I don't know if connoisseur is the right word, but you've got to have a sort of more committed interest in a way to music to you know, to get listening to film scores. So if anything, it means more than what you might call, I don't know, a general public reaction. I know it's a really long-winded answer, but the bottom line is it means a lot. And you'll have to show me these these favorable reports.
Will do, will do. And you know, just touching on, you know, you touched on your background, your background in music. How did you get wrapped up in film music? What point in your life did that become an interest of yours?
I can't believe I didn't do it earlier. If you look on, musically I'm a bit prodigal son in a way. Like when I grew up, my father was an orchestral arranger and a composer, and I spent, you know, most of my early childhood being shouted at from the bathroom to rush upstairs to hand my father manuscript paper while he was in the bath so he could, you know, write down ideas. And, you know, I'd be playing some kind of board game or something in my room when I was seven, and Dad would be shouting from the kitchen, quick, you know, come downstairs, Bartok's Miraculous Mandarins on the radio. And I had to, like, sit down with the score with him, aged eight, you know, and try and follow these, like, hemi-demi-semi-quaver, you know, triplet runs. And, you know, you're turning the page every, like, 6 seconds, desperately trying to even get a handle on what the hell's going on. So I had quite a sort of, for want of a better word, I don't know about highbrow, because Dad was really eclectic. He'd listen to that, and then he'd listen to the Sex Pistols, so, you know, it was all good, basically. And, you know, I went to, like, a cathedral choir school. I was singing 4 hours of Palestrina and Tallis and 16th century, you know, Italian church music and all the rest of it, and went to music college and all this kind of business. And then at 18, that just all went out the window because a friend of mine came round with an Amiga computer, which you guys probably never got in America, I don't know. But it had a crappy sort of 8-bit sampler on it, and that was it. It was as if the, you know, previous 12 years of classical education simply went on hold while I grew long hair, wore tie-dye T-shirts, slammed together breakbeats and made rave music for a while, and then drifted off into pop and started hanging out with Trevor Horn, and which is the, you know, the posher end of pop. Not I'd sort of grown out of the rave thing by then. And I was sort of in pop music, weirdly enough, which is so contradictory with the background I've just described. And then Hans Zimmer heard something. I got a bit bored with a few projects I was working on and did some album of my own that I think I was probably subconsciously using Bjork's Homogenic as a kind of aesthetic template, meaning it had gurgling, weird electronica, plus it had real recorded strings and real choir and stuff like that. It was nowhere near Homogenic. Is a Homogenic and Vespertine are two untouchable albums, you know, in my opinion. Anyway, in my piffling way, I was sort of heading in that direction. And Hans heard it, and he just said, why are you doing pop music? You're a complete waste of time. You should be doing film music. And for some reason, I was like, oh. And he goes, look, you've got more bloody background than I have. What the hell are you doing, you know, messing around in pop music? And I'm like, well, you can talk. Didn't he, you know, he was ribbing me, you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, what are you proposing? And then he's like, well, you should, you know, get into it. So I started hanging out at his place, and I was very lucky. He was basically seeing something in me that I, for some reason, had noticed and was determined to bring it out, which is a quite peculiar and extraordinary and quite selfless skill.
Yeah, and it seems like Hans genuinely looks to bring out the best in the talented composers that are out there, perhaps in a way that they themselves don't even see it. It seems genuine, doesn't it?
Oh, it is totally genuine. And if you think about it, it's mad. I mean, given the you know, competitive and sort of generally egotistical world we live in, just the fact that someone is not just comfortable but positively takes pleasure out of that happening is quite a compliment to the man, because I can think of a lot of scenarios where someone would be trying to do the precise opposite, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I look at the transition that the composers have made that works with him, you know, eventually getting their own projects and eventually establishing themselves. It's a good thing, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'm talking of his, prodding me. In one of the very early things I was doing with him, I was, you know, having spent all this time in records, I was kind of making weird and cool noises and doing extra sound design and this, that, and the other. And he was like, oh, when are you going to stop messing around with that and just, like, launch into orchestral music? And I think, you know, some of it might have been an almost slightly juvenile thing of, you know, if you've been to all these music colleges and you, you know, when you were 12, you were playing, you know, Mozart horn concertos and everything. By the time I was 17, you know, it was all hooded tops and Technics 1210s. I didn't necessarily want anyone to know that I'd spent all this time playing, like, Doc Nardi finger exercises, because I was too busy being cool. So it might have been a bit of like, oh, yeah, orchestral music, that's, you know, it's a bit lame. It's for, like, you know, old people. I'll get into that shit, you know, when I'm older. And when I was working with Hans, I realized what an unbelievably immature attitude that was. Because at one point he was like, come, when are you going to do orchestral music? And I was like, oh, you know, well, I, you know, I'm just going to carry on doing some of these textures because I can't be bothered with all that, you know, orchestral nonsense. And he turns to me really cleverly and goes, oh, well, you know, fair enough. You're obviously just some kind of drum and bass guy. That's pretty much all you can do. And I was like, oh, I was ready for a fight.
Laying down the gauntlet.
How dare you? I could go to the piano right now and work my way through, you know, a lot of Brahms Rhapsodies. So don't you dare just call me a drummer. He knew what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
He was just poking me. And I was like, all right, come on then.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah, exactly. And I've had an enormous amount of fun. I think, you know what else it was? It's that thing of the vicar's son. Meaning, I don't know what the word is, and you know, the vicar being like the priest. You know, the vicar's son's always the one who smokes a lot of weed and has a motorbike and all the rest of it because his dad's a bit, you know, clean and perfect and all the rest of it. I think part of avoiding orchestral music in a way was because dad was really good at it. So, you know, I was sort of moving into the samplers and the noises and the production and everything. So that might have been part of it, just trying to find my own little space, given that I'd spent my entire childhood watching him run around with giant pieces of school paper and scribbling things down. You know, you just want to be different. I suppose I was just being bloody-minded.
Well, I'd have to say that the journey that you took, at the end of the day, probably has made you a better composer, musician, etc., because of the different experiences,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, pop music is not to be knocked. There's lots of disciplines you learn for pop music. Number one among them, the power of one idea simply presented and endlessly worked on. And just as importantly, if you work, I can always tell people, well, there's two parts of it in film music. One is sonic, meaning people who've worked on records are used to dealing potentially, you know, with a 4-minute piece of music might only have 3 chords in it, but it just sounds great. And guess why? Because you've worked really, really hard on everything. The kick sounds great, the kit sounds good, the programming sounds good, the guitars sound good, the mix sounds good, the vocal sound, you know, there's like 29 plugins on the vocal, there's like 7,000 automation moves. It's an obsession with the visceral nature of sound, especially if you work with Trevor Horn. I mean, you know, it just, guy takes 3 years to do an album, you know, and it sounds great at the end of it, but it's not necessarily an exercise in, you know, if you put a Scriabin piano sonata next to a you know, a Seal record. There are less, well, actually, Seal's a bad example because they're pretty sophisticated chords in Seal. But if you put, you know what I'm saying, if you take a really, really well-made pop chart, it's not going to get even close harmonically to the kind. You could write a 10-side essay about the harmonic voodoo going on in a Scriabin piano sonata, whereas, you know, in a pop piece, you might just have three chords. But then, you know, no one's trying to win any awards for harmony and that stuff. It's a really powerful tune or a melody or connecting with people as a general, you know, sociological thing. Plus the production is really, really, really thoughtful, and you know, people kill themselves to get that stuff right. And then the other part of it is, if you've, from my background, being the age I'm at and in London, it means you just inherit a whole load of, anyone of my age would have been listening to, you know, drum and bass and trip hop and the whole thing that happened in Bristol with Portishead and Ronnie Size and all that. And it just kind of leaks into your system, so that when you do electronica, it doesn't sound like your grandpa trying to do it.
Right. Probably not very commercial if that's the case.
Right. You know what I mean? It's just, I feel you can sort of tell when people aren't quite inhabiting electronica so much as knowing that they've been asked to do it. You know what I mean? And if mm-hmm. if you've got some feeling for it, I think it helps. It's not to say that, you know, any film composer who wants to use electronica needs to have been, like, hanging around with a hooded top under the M25 tunnels as a teenager, you know, bopping up and down to the Chemical Brothers. It just, you know, I'm just saying that if it's seeped its way naturally into your subconscious and you've even spent some professional time making underground records, you know, making white label records or dance records, then that, you know, it doesn't do any harm.
Indeed, indeed, and yeah, you're right. Everyone's journey is different, and that's why we're all unique, I would say.
Exactly.
And speaking
of, you know, any of that from, because Gullivers was, you know, purely orchestral, but, you know, very early on, I made the decision it was nothing short of foolish to try and shoehorn any sort of inappropriate sort of aesthetics into a movie that had such a clearly defined visual aesthetic, and instead to celebrate, you know, the great works of Messrs. Williams and Silvestri, who obviously, I'm not comparing myself to them because they are literally two massive legends. But, you know, you can definitely, you might as well aim high.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And speaking of first-class talent, and then just as we wrap up here, are you able to provide us an update on where you're at with the new X-Men movie?
The new X-Men movie is extremely exciting, and things are going well. I'm wondering how much I should say, other than I hope when it comes out, everyone's going to enjoy the movie and hopefully also the music, because there's quite a lot going on that you wouldn't have been hearing in Gulliver's Travels. There's going to be a lot of orchestra. What I'm trying to do with X-Men is not end up in one of those mutually exclusive situations, by which I mean, like in Gulliver's Travels, because there isn't production, you have, for want of a better word, quite posh, you know, orchestration, all the rest of it. And just because now there is hybrid elements in electronica, I don't then necessarily want that to, I don't know what the word would be, kind of contain and restrict the harmony and composition. There's got to be some way that I can have my cake and eat it, where if you mute it, all the hybrid and strange elements and just focus on the orchestra, it's still good writing that would, you know, stand on its own two feet as sufficiently, you know, interesting and well orchestrated, except that it's just enhanced with a bunch of other stuff instead of having so much, you know, pounding production that under the bonnet, you know, the composition actually ain't all that. So that I'm trying to find a way to have my cake and eat it, and I suppose people can figure out whether I've completely failed or not later.
And I guess in a way, is it almost like aiming to have each layer be able to stand on its own if needed?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Meaning there's, I don't know if it's a sort of old-fashioned idea, but I just, however much, especially in action stuff, I don't know. I mean, sometimes you do have to use an orchestra as a visceral machine, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I've heard all sorts of brilliant cues that last, you know, 2.5 minutes and mostly in one key and with a fairly repetitive situation. I mean, you know, there's so many different ways to skin a cat that there just aren't any rules, because someone who does something well just does something well regardless of how or what the mechanics are. But I guess what I'm, yeah, I think you're right, in as much as if I built some action cue and there's so much production that sounds great that I could pretty much get away with the strings just going for like 84 bars. I don't really want to do it. I want to have it so that there, you know, it's a kind of marriage, so that the orchestral writing doesn't get compromised. It'll be a little tricky because, you know, you've got to shoehorn the various different elements together. So yeah, there'll be a happy medium. You know, you can't have an action cue in X-Men. It's going to be exactly like Gulliver's, because that really is just the whole. The orchestra is entirely delivering the sense of action. So all sorts of tricks and chops are being deployed, you know, in terms of orchestration that are required precisely because there aren't, you know, there isn't a whole ton of production, and you can't have, you know, two cakes on top of each other. But I'm going to try and find a way to just sort of make a cake out of, make a kind of slightly unique cake out of good production, which if you listen to on its own, you'd enjoy, and orchestration that never gets lazy.
Well, I'd have to say that I'm ready for this dessert. I genuinely loved and enjoyed what you did with Gulliver's Travels, and I'm definitely excited to hear where you arrive at with X-Men First Class.
Well, great. Well, thanks for interviewing me.
My pleasure, and thanks for a wonderful conversation. I wish you all the best.
All right, thanks, Tom.